copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I don't think I need to convince you that we live in a rapidly changing world. And I don't think I need to convince you that we need to understand this world well in order to communicate Christ's character effectively. When it comes to sexuality and human rights, you know that we're seeing all kinds of changes going on. So it's a wonderful idea that Nola and Charlie, I think you guys came up with the idea to actually focus on this idea of sexuality and human rights. Now, what I want us to notice, and I really appreciate you guys the way that you framed it, because we're not starting with sexual rights. And that's a really important point, because what we want to do is work out what is the distinction between the two. They're quickly conflated in our society. All around us, we'll talk about sexual rights, but what we want to do is work out what are the mechanisms and the drivers that are working through this idea of sexual rights. So we want to split those up today and work out this distinction. A part of the reason why we want to do this is because we don't want to be engaging in a discussion in which we don't know what are the assumptions driving these words in society. We want to have a very clear idea about what society is talking about when we come to society to interact with them. So that's what we want to do. Now, if we have a look at the World Health Organization, they're really quite clear about the distinction between human rights and sexuality. Very, very clear indeed. Let me read this to you. The application of existing human rights to sexuality constitutes sexual rights. Let me say it again. The application of existing human rights to sexuality constitutes human rights. So sexuality and human rights, they're not the same thing, but come into contact when society desires sexuality, a particular form of sexuality, to be protected. So that's the answer to our question, right? What is the relationship between a secular view of sexuality and human rights? Well, human rights are a way of protecting a particular view of sexuality, of good concerning sexuality. So we could go home now, but that's too short. We have 35 to 40 minutes here to talk this out a bit. That's a what question. What I want to focus on is how and why. And I think as people engaging on these issues in society, we have to get to how and why questions. How do human rights protect what society holds to be good concerning sexuality? Why do human rights protect what society holds to be good concerning sexuality? So let's tackle those two questions, how and why, by seeking to understand where we have come from. I can't stress enough, if we're going to engage society at this moment, we must know how we got here. So to begin to tackle this question, let's think about the sexual revolution, okay? Part B there. Now, I often hear that this moment is the result of the sexual revolution that began in the late 1960s. We've all heard that narrative. And of course, this is true to some extent. I'm going to challenge it soon. It was a moment in time, you know, when traditional values were thrown out the window. Sex outside of marriage became good and normal. We came to understand that an idea of woman that was tightly linked to a sink and a vacuum cleaner and raising children was not adequate and highly unfulfilling. And importantly, in this moment in time, we came to understand that conservative values just weren't good enough for helping us to understand what is good when it comes to sexuality. So the sexuality is not a reform movement, and that's important to note. It's a revolution. It turns society on its head, right? So in May 1968, that's the day where we kind of plot this kind of revolution. Society, you know, exploded from its cultural shackles, these chains that had been repressing it and holding it down for so long. This is where we have come from. But what about gender? When we think about gender in this moment, and the social attitudes that have been kind of changing in the last 5 to 10 years, should we think of this as a gender revolution? It certainly feels like an explosion from these traditional views, right? You know, we've been freed and liberated from all of this, these traditional ideas. But I don't think it is a revolution. I'm inclined to call this period in time a reform, a gender reform. And the difference is this. A revolution, generally speaking, is what happens outside of the existing structures. It turns all those on its head. Whereas reform happens within the existing structures. So what we're experiencing now is not an overturning of society and its structures, but this slow and steady growing within our social structures over the past 30 years, fruit that was now starting to bloom from this tree that has been slowly growing for some time. This moment is the result of the sexual revolution, but here's my challenge. But only because the sexual revolution failed. We have to understand that. This moment is the product of the sexual revolution, but only because the sexual revolution failed. This moment in time is the result of the sexual revolution because the sexual revolution couldn't grant everyone their sexual desires to be understood as normal and good. We must understand this part of our recent history. Gender reform is happening because the sexual revolution failed. That's my basic kind of premise. In other words, because the sexual revolution was unable to secure sexual freedom for all people, including those who were lesbian and gay, another movement had to begin that could take the sexual revolution to its logical conclusion. So do you understand that move that we need to understand this moment? So in the middle, from the early to the mid 1980s, a number of intellectuals, mainly women, who were lesbians, were coming to the realization that the problem was not a cultural script, a cultural idea that needed to be kind of overthrown. The issue to be tackled was, in fact, a set of beliefs, foundations. A set of beliefs that stated that good sexuality was grounded in this thing called nature. That's the problem. Good and normal sexuality was this: attraction to and sex with a person of the other sex. Okay? So from this perspective, these gay and lesbian intellectuals, that the problem stopping society from embracing them was actually this law of nature that kind of founded this this foundation of society. The picture of two bodies is this kind of idea. Two bodies define the human in human rights. A man and a woman together. Though we had thrown off the shackles of fidelity and marriage and stuff, man and woman compose the idea of the human in the human rights. So no amount of revolution or revolt can change these fundamental foundations that were structuring up society. So in response, these intellectuals, they sought to find another way, another political avenue to change society so that these people who were not accepted could be brought in and included as normal and as good. This kind of move is what I call a politics of desire. That's a fairly known idea in philosophical terms, in the philosophical world. But it's a politics of desire. And the goal of the politics of desire was to reform the human in the human rights. Reforming the human that was the foundation of human rights. Reforming the human that founded our idea of who is allowed into the idea of normal in society. So let's move on to the next section, the old frame. So as I just mentioned, this moment of sexuality and gender change began as a revolution. Get this, it began as a revolution, but has become more a product of reform. So in order to understand the relationship between a secular idea of sexuality and human rights, we need to understand this idea of reform. How is this reform happening? An important aspect of understanding how this reform is happening is that it happened within the existing structures of society. It didn't move outside. It operated within. So these, I'll call them sexuality reformers. These sexuality reformers worked within this old frame to secure new results. Okay? So our task is to understand the basic structure of the old frame that they use to bring about social reform that we're experiencing now, the fruit that we're experiencing now. And so to do this, I'm going to reflect upon the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So let's turn to that now. The desire for life. The motor that drives, the thing that drives the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in this old frame is a desire for life, a particular kind of life. So in this declaration, life is understood as freedom for all. In the preamble, we read that this life is described as having freedom of speech and belief, freedom from fear, and freedom from want. The founders of the document, they tell us that these freedoms are the common people's highest aspiration. That's the kind of founding moment there. So do you see how this old frame works here? An idea of the good is articulated as that to which we all in society aspire. Here it is over here. And then we're all invited to come around it together to do what is needed to make this idea of good, this idea of life, for everyone. We need to secure this idea of life for everyone. Now, these kinds of declarations, they don't just spring out of nowhere, do they? This one came on the heels of two horrible world wars, of course the Holocaust as well. And so this period of time, it shocked humanity, especially the Western world, to see that however much progress we had made, we still had this horrible, horrible streak in us, where we would kill each other and do all kinds of awful things to each other. And so human rights were seen as this kind of saviour, in a sense, to inhibit violence, to slow it down, to stop it, so that we could all enjoy this life, right? So the appeal to rights comes from a desire for life. So when we look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, what is the ground of these human rights? What's the foundation of them? And where does the authority come from? And this is the important question that we'll get to at the end, from which we can keep these rights safe and secure in society. So this takes us to this idea of means, part B. How, I suppose. So what's the foundation of this desire for life and human rights? Well, again, in the preamble, we read that there are two foundations, inherent dignity and inalienable rights. They're the two big foundations there. The words inherent and inalienable, they both try and capture this stuckness, this permanence of dignity and rights to every human. So in other words, just because I am human, for no other reason than that, I get to experience these things. The point I'm trying to draw out here is that human rights are developed and protected in these early stages on the basis of a human that had, here's the word, assumed dignity and value. We just think that was the case. We assume that this is the case, okay? The next way that a desire for life is promoted, number two there, and protected, is through the governing mechanism of democracy, right? We're trying to understand the old frame here, the architecture, okay? So while the word democracy is not used in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, democracy is the chosen, explicitly chosen governance structure that is going to oversee the administration and regulation of this idea of life that is good. Article 21 is interesting because not only does it state the role of democracy in a nation, but also how it operates. We're after how and whys, okay? We're trying to burrow down, not just what. Listen to what it says. This is the first line of point 3 in Article 21. The will of the people shall be the basis of authority. The will of the people shall be the basis of authority of the government. We'll come back to that soon when we go to the new frame. That's a door into a whole lot of pain. But here is the value of democracy, in that society works together to find people who are willing to uphold what we have said is our highest aspiration, what is life. This is what democracy does for us. So then we move on to the next point. Point 3 is the law. But before that, let me just summarize. The old frame. Life is secured by appealing to inherent dignity and inalienable rights, by appealing to this democratic process to make sure that it is realized for all, okay? The final means, the final how that we keep this idea of life going in our society is by law. By gearing our civil laws and international laws to this idea of life, we actually safeguard this idea of life. And so we can enjoy our rights as much as we want, the Declaration says, as long as you don't, well, impact someone else's rights. So the controlling factor there are other people's rights, but the way that we mediate that is by having a law in our countries and internationally to help arbitrate that. So to sum up section 2, the old frame is tightly linked to desiring life, and not just any life, a particular life for all. The old frame is concerned with nations and societies working together to serve each other's and secure everyone's highest aspiration, this idea of life, right? And we use our democratic means and the law to secure this life for everyone. I think this is a fairly familiar picture when we break it down like that. We understand that this is how our society kind of works. Well, let's move now on to the new frame. I'm calling it the new frame just to distinguish it from the old frame, but it's the same structure, right? Because we know that the new frame is going to use that same structure. We're going to see now that there's a real subtle movement in how society thinks about the human at the base of that, human rights. And what we're going to see is that by reforming the human, human rights are also reformed. So what these theorists did is they understood that it's all about the foundation. You can procedurally, you can set up society through law and government all you like. We've done that with racism, right? But have we changed society? Yeah, kind of, but we haven't rooted it out, have we? Get to the foundation, change people's beliefs. That's how we're going to change society. That's the general move that's going to be made here. So once again, let's think about this desire for life. So as I mentioned early, changes that are taking in place are not revolutionary political theories, but they're using what's already in place. And this means that the basic premise of this new frame is the same as the old frame, desiring life for everyone. It's the same thing. The difference is that what is life in the new frame is different to what the old frame offered. For these new intellectuals in the 1980s, who saw the failure of the sexual revolution happening, they didn't see particular goods like education and medical treatment and leisure time and the right to work and speak and believe that. They didn't see that as good. Life for these people was still concerned with good, but a different kind of good. Good becomes not a particular thing. That's the problem. Good sexuality is no longer a specifiable thing. Before it was, remember, man and woman, attracted to each other, they have sex with one another. That is a good thing. It's a particular idea that you can put your finger on, you can kind of point out what's what. We're going to turn now to see that what is good is not a particular thing. So what is good if it's not a particular thing? What is good is a particular posture towards the other person. Good sexuality is not a specifiable thing, but a posture towards the other person that is not exclusionary and oppressive and violent. Okay, we know those words everywhere. So if what is good is a posture towards the other person, how should we understand this posture? What characterizes it? Well, in short, it's a posture of desire. But this posture of desire does not concern my desires. It concerns their desires. So what is good is a posture of desiring other people's desires. Do you see that? So what then must I desire about the other person's desire? Well, the short answer to the question is life. I must be deeply concerned with their desire to live, right? This means that what is good concerning sexuality and gender, I'm just throwing it all in there, is living in a posture that seeks the realization that the coming to life of their desire to live. So in this new frame here, the question is not, do I desire a particular kind of life for a person? That's the old frame. But do I desire a person's desire to live? And so, of course, the question that rings in my mind when I hear that, well, what do we mean by life, right? But also importantly, and what this politics of desire does, it takes our attention off life and turns us to the idea of desire. So let's think about that first, point number one, the relationship between desire and life. Desire teaches me and you, us, that we are dependent upon the world for our life. It's actually a beautiful theological statement, right? That's what God said was very good. Everything he had made was very good. I desire air and food and water and love, all these things. And if I don't get these things, I'm going to die. All those things exist outside of me. I desire them. I need them for my life. If I go without air and food and water, I'm going to die a physical death, right? If I go without warmth and security and love, I'm going to die a metaphorical death of neglect and loneliness. I cannot have life without the world around me. This is a basic move in this politics of desire. I can't have life without the world around me, which means that I'm dependent upon you for my life. Imagine if the whole hotel says to me, you can't have food down here for the whole week. You hold the keys to my life. I desire food for life. You withhold them from me. So you, so if you don't desire my life, and you'll desire my life, that's why you let me walk in and eat the good food. But if you don't desire my life, then I will die. A literal death, and we see that in the world. We don't desire some lives, and so they die, literally. But we also see that if we don't desire people's health and well-being and need for care and love, they will die a metaphorical death. So my life is in your hands, which means that I am in a very, very, very vulnerable position. But notice that I'm not just dependent upon Charlie for my life, for example. I'm dependent upon all of you for my life. And you are dependent upon all of us for our life. Can you see what's happening here? What is good is not a particular thing, but a realization that we all hold the keys to everybody's life. And when we understand this, we're supposed to be moved to be generous towards the other person's desire to live, their desire for life. Let's move on to part two, reframing the discussion. What I'm observing here is a fundamental reform in how we think of the terms life and good. I hope you've seen that. The discussion is reframed, this discussion of gender and sexuality is reframed by this reform of the human. I hope we can see that the real issue that the new frame is seeking to address is power. In the new frame, the change in thinking about what is good is about stripping those with the power to determine what is good for you to enjoy as life. So when we finally turn to the question, what is life, we don't get the chance to answer it, do we? If we want to answer the question, what is life, we see that the question highlights my desire to impose a particular idea on you, which may not be your desire for life. So to ask the question, what is desire, what is life, demonstrates that I do not desire another person's desire to live. But what it shows, in fact, is that I seek to impose on this person a particular idea of life that they need to enjoy for life. This means that the question that confronts each member in society is not what is good, but will you desire another person's desire for life? Will you desire this person's desires? Will you desire their sexual desires for life? Or will you withhold from them the possibility of life? Are you seeing how the discussion about rights and sexuality and gender has changed in this kind of way? Debates about marriage rights for gay and lesbians are reframed around this reform of the human, around this idea of what is good, what is life. This means that the question being debated is not what is a good life, what is good, but whether I will desire the other person's desire to marry someone of the same sex. Will you desire their desire? It's a civic responsibility. Or will I withhold life from them? And so we bumped into the present secular ideas of responsibility and loving one's neighbour. It's very, very Christian at one level. I'm responsible and loving when I tend to a person's desire to live. Who's going to disagree with that statement? When I vote yes to a same-sex marriage vote, for example, I am demonstrating responsibility and love to the other person who desires this for life. So the heart of the modern politics of desire is whether you and I will perform our civic duty and embrace life. That's why it's a very short discussion. It's life and death. Can you see what is being constructed here in this new frame? It mimics what Jesus desires of Christians. It mimics. It's not the reality. It's not true, but it mimics it. Love your neighbour by tending to those in need. Don't make up an idea of good in life according to your own desires, right? Romans 1 is explicit, isn't it, when it comes to desire. The curse that has fallen on humanity is that it suffers at the hands of its own desires. About five times, Paul says, they've been handed over to their desires. In this new frame, where are those evils of individualism? In this new frame, where is the evil of autonomy? Well, they're gone, aren't they? Each person is stripped of their right to impose their desires on another person for life. Each person is not permitted to go after their own desires. They must pursue the desires of others. Do you see? In this human-constructed schema of what is good, the human has realized that we are our worst enemies. And so we must limit our impact on others by installing an idea of good that pushes away any capacity to be violent towards the other person. Of course, when you're talking about bombs and nuclear weapons, it's pretty easy. But now we've turned it around to be talking about sexuality and these more personal issues. What is good life? What is a good life is living in community and striving for the life of the other. That's how it operates now. So what is the idea or the right that tops all others in this new frame? It's not freedom of speech, is it? We know that. It's not tolerance. It's not autonomy. It's not individualism. It certainly is not freedom of religion, is it? Or belief. You see, the very point of this reform movement of what is life is to, here's the word, queer, shake, undermine, rattle, rights. That's what they're trying to do. And because rights are self-obsessed. They're about me. Rights frame a social posture towards the other that frame exclusion because it's based on a particular idea of good. I appeal to this idea of good to exclude that person from a different kind of life. So by installing the other person's desire for life as this kind of ultimate virtue, it's a theoretical masterstroke. It really is, because it gets my attention off me. My rights, my prerogative, my voice, my beliefs, and it refocuses all of them on the desires of others. So can you see how this kind of thinking can be seen as unselfish and as loving and as caring? What is love? All of those things. It's humble. But notice also that in reformulating what is life in this kind of way, towards a posture towards the other person's desire, it also reformulates what is evil, what is not good. So in this new frame, if I desire my own desires, I become the one who withholds life from people, right? I am not loving. I am selfish. I'm ungracious, I'm unproud, I am, if I'm going to impose my desires on others, I'm a perpetrator of violence. I oppress. I'm exclusionary because I only reserve life for those who think that this is life. Everyone else is out. We are in a new discussion, and this is the discussion that we're in. So let's move on to the next part, the means. Remember that we talked about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and we saw that one of those means was democracy, which made the will of society the ground of authority. That was the point I wanted to kind of draw out. And I want to suggest that this is the weak spot in modern democratic nations. And by weak spot, this is what I mean. I mean that this is the point where good and what is life is able to be reformed to something else. So according to this new frame, the foundation of what is a good life is not human dignity and inalienable rights, but the will of those in power who decided that this is what is our highest aspiration. Who got to decide that this was the common people's highest aspiration? Well, some people somewhere, right? Who gets to decide what is life? That's what the new frame is working against. So there appears to be some kinds of truth in Alistair MacIntyre, you may have read some of his work, in this, his response to the idea of human rights. He says, there are no such rights, and belief in them is one with belief in witches and in unicorns. Because what he saw was that it was an assumed human at the bottom of the system. This is the basic premise that this reform can operate on, the assumption that there's some kind of givenness to what I am as a human. The problem with the old frame, these theorists thought, was that some people somewhere got to decide what was the human in the human rights, man and woman. And the new frame says, no way, we're not doing that. Because there are some humans that don't look like and feel like and have sex like those humans. Their idea is, no, we as a people will decide what is good, what is life, what is the human. What is good is freedom of speech and religion and freedom from fear and want. What good is all of that if I can't marry the person who I love? For example. So in the past, we broadly agreed that life and good when it comes to sexuality and gender, which democracy and the law safeguard, we broadly agreed on that stuff. But now we're in a time where we don't agree with that stuff. It's no longer present in society, this general idea. And so democracy changes, has a different responsibility now, a different shape. Not only does it maintain and regulate what we agree upon, but now it becomes the mechanism by which we come to understand what is good, sexuality. What is good, a life. So for a secular society who has thrown out God, there's no God in the foundation, what is life and good is not an absolute truth, clearly. And so whatever is true is whatever we agree upon together. What is good and life for society now is always subject to a discussion. It's always subject to a contest. It is political, right? What is moral is now adjudicated by the will of the people. Which means that, and here's the line, morality has been democratized. So whatever society thinks is moral is moral. So in my own country, Australia, we had a same-sex marriage referendum a couple of years back. And we saw that that on one day before the vote, same-sex marriage and that kind of life was not good. It was illegal. It was not life. We voted. Australia came to the understanding as a people that it was good. And so the next day, what was not good becomes good. And so the government and the law now must react to now regulate and maintain and put this into practice in society. It must respect the will of the people who have decided that this is good. Do you see how it works? The new frame seeks to challenge the assumption that a human being is something in particular. If it's not something in particular, It's something that we've agreed upon. It is. We agree on what is a human now. So according to my reading of the New Frame, we come to understand a secular view of sexuality as not merely fruit of the sexual revolution. And I can't press this more. If it's just fruit of the sexual revolution, it's just a kind of autonomous individuality narrative. I'm saying it's more than that. It's more complex than that. That's why it's been a complex talk. We have to get to the complexity of what's going on. It's a reform movement. What we're seeing is fruit of the reform. A secular view of sexuality is not something in particular. We have to get our minds to that. But a posture towards the other and the idea that society determines what is sexually good and worth protecting with our human rights, existing human rights. So as we saw at the beginning, human rights are a way of protecting what society understands is sexuality, right? The trouble is not with human rights or with sexuality, in my mind, but with the democratization of sexuality. So human rights are therefore this mechanism that protects society's desire for its own ideas of what is good when it comes to sexuality and gender. So let's conclude this section here by thinking about the World Health Organization's claim between the connection between human rights and sexuality. Remember, our question is, what is the relationship between a secular view of sexuality and human rights? This is how we might rephrase the World Health Organization statement. The application of existing human rights to, not sexuality, but democratized ideas of sexuality constitutes sexual rights. When we enter into discussions about sexuality or gender, we're entering into discussions about democratized ideas of sexuality and gender. We're entering into a frame that actually supports this and has historically supported this very idea. So let's move on to the last part very quickly. Reflecting from a Christian perspective, my view is that you guys probably have more to say about this than me. I deal with the theoretical side of things, where you guys are deeply at the coalface thinking about these issues, and I really want to hear your thoughts. But I've got a broad kind of reflections. And the first one is that we must enter the discussion. And historically, we have not. And by that, I mean this. These theorists that I'm referring to, these intellectuals in the mid-80s, they went through for about 20 years, 15 years, being viewed upon as absolutely absurd. It's rubbish what they're doing. But what we've seen is over time is that it's taken root and it's grown, and now we've seen it bear fruit. And my lament is that we're just starting in the last couple of years to really put pressure on ourselves to go, no, we've got to get to the bottom of this. We need to get into the discussion, which I'm saying we need to get people into avenues of we need to be creating avenues of getting people into these positions to be thinkers, to be communicating with people like yourselves who are at the coalface doing this work. But the second point about entering the discussion is, do we know what the discussion is about? I think if it's about the sexual revolution, we've missed the point of the discussion. If we're talking about what is life, we're missing what they're talking about. We want to talk about what is life, don't we? But that's the challenge now. If we're going to enter the discussion, we must know what is going on. We can't come into a dinner table and just start talking about something different. Everyone just kind of looks at you and says, what are you doing? We're talking about something different. So do we know the discussion? As people on the front line, we must know the discussion taking place. We must know our history, where people are coming from. But on a more practical note, we need to see that this new frame and the way it's structured is a trap. It's a trap. Either way you go, for a conservative Christian like myself, you find yourself, you know, stuck. And it reminds me of, and I really reflect upon this passage a lot, even though it's a bit contested, is in John, where Jesus is confronted with the Pharisees and the adulterous woman. And John said, it's a trap. You can choose faithfulness to the law, truth, or you can choose mercy. What are you going to choose? Whichever way he chooses, he's going to be horribly violent, she's going to be stoned to death, or he's going to forsake the law and be unfaithful to God. It's a trap, right? So we have to understand that the way this has been reframed, it's a trap. And I like what Jesus does, because he doesn't forsake the law and he doesn't forsake mercy. He doesn't forsake the truth. But nor does he speak. He responds in the first instance with shutting his mouth. Because the Pharisees say, "So what do you say, Jesus?" That's the cue. Step into the trap, Jesus, and condemn yourself as well with this woman. We need to work out, I think, when we need to be quiet. How we can encourage our churches, our people on social media to be quiet. Where we can be reflective. Where we can be prayerful. Where we can come to these issues with more clarity than adding more white noise. And the last thing I'd like to say about entering the discussion is we have to be creative to be forming new spaces where we can have these discussions on our terms. Hey, Australia, should we legalise same-sex marriage? Yes or no? Is that all the Christian gets to say? One or two words? Is that all we get to say? We didn't hear about Jesus in the discussion because all we said was yes or no. Which takes me to, well, in terms of being creative, here's a few more ideas that have worked for me more recently. Is confession, beginning with confession. Because the charge is violence. You've been violent. You've been oppressive. And there is a modicum of truth to that. Where in history have Christian ideas been the foundation that has driven horrible forms of violence? The kind of medical institutionalisation, the medicalisation of trying to repair people from disordered desire. A lot of that, historically, even though it's latent in a kind of Taylor kind of way, it's a historical Christian heritage that's driving that, man and woman. But if we're going to desire another person's life, which is the second part, I think that we need to find ways to be creative to demonstrate that we do. And I think confession is a wonderful starting place. So, for example, the main way society has received the church's response to the AIDS epidemic in the 80s is as an organisation that clapped and cheered. Yes, they're dying, they got what they deserved. We weren't nursing them and bathing them and caring for them, despite the fact that we totally disagree with that lifestyle as God's intent for their good. But they heard us cheering and shouting. We are a body of Christ. We can't blame them or that person or this person or that person, that denomination, that country. As a body of Christ, could confession be a place where we can begin a different discussion, where we actually take the charge and go, yeah, we, in some ways we have been absolutely horrible, unchristian in the way that we've treated people. In my experience, that's given me an opportunity to come around and then speak in a constructive sense. When we have seminars, they're often Christian worldview on sexuality and gender. Why not? What is a human? Created or made? What other angles can we get at to begin to explore some of these ideas of sexuality and rights without just kind of going straight to the topic from a Christian point of view? Just some questions for you. And then finally, desiring another person's life, we must have a tone and vocabulary that actually models that this is actually our heart's desire. And they must see that that's our heart desire. Not from my words, but from my posture and my tone and my word choice. I have many gay friends, and they totally disagree with my work, but they really appreciate it, and they've told me face to face. They've been thankful for the way that I've engaged it. I'm like, oh, is that all I needed to do? Well, just kind of be a bit nice about this. We need to make sure that our tone and our words are reflecting this. Of course, we need to have friends who are gay, trans, struggling with gender dysphoria, people who are most careful with their words and most loving towards these people are people who have friends and family members who are struggling with these things. So it's a real advantage to know people in that world. And finally, this is my theological note. I think we're stuck in Genesis. We're not, are we? We're not in Genesis. The way that we communicate, I think, needs to be brought into God's redemptive plan. That is, yeah, creation happened. Jesus reinforces it in Matthew 19. It still is paradigmatic, but it fell. None of us can get back into Eden. And so we're driven to the cross, right? That's where there is life. And of course, after that, Paul is wonderful in Romans 8, saying, no, our bodies are going to groan. This is an expected reality. We're waiting for the final redemption of our bodies. Somehow we need to get creative in trying to bring this into our discussions, maybe not explicitly, but certainly underpinning it, so that this is the latent force of our arguments and our discussions. So let me leave it there. That's plenty of information for now, and we can have a chat.
Thanks very much.
No problem.